What's going on, everyone? Welcome to another episode of Conspiracy or Just a Coincidence. I am Jack Allen. Follow me on Twitter, Conspiracy or JAC. I got a new logo made by my best friend, Liv Allen. It's sweet. She made me look much stronger than I actually am, but I love that. I know this is the third time I changed my logo, but third time is a charm, and it looks awesome. So please follow me on all those things if you want to support the show. I got a website, conspiracyorjustacoincidence.com, and I have all my links on my Twitter, and I'm on Odyssey. Please go subscribe on YouTube. And I think, you know, I try to keep it so they'll keep me. I just try to talk history. Sometimes I regret my name of my show, but so subscribe there. And I'm always doing new books. If you got a book that I need to read, tell me about it, because I will try and read it. It might be a little bit, but thanks for listening, everybody. It means so much. I keep getting nice reviews. And again, they mean so much to me. If you can support the show or can't support the show, I get it. But if you can leave a review, that almost means more to me than donating your support. So today's show, I got one of my favorite people in this world, the Odd Man. Odd Man is a genius. He's one of the best, most well-read people I've ever met. We talk all the time not IRL, but via text and messaging. And I just respect his opinion so much. He's somebody that I just can't say enough nice things about. So go follow the Odd Man. If you're not, you need to follow him. He is great. He sees through the lies. He's helped me see through so many lies. And it's underscore. Oh God, I should have had it up. But I think it is underscore at the underscore the Odd Man Out. So at the underscore the Odd Man Out. So go follow him there. I'm going to try and finish my notes for tomorrow. We're going to talk about kind of what some of the things we touched on tonight, but how World War I was started by Britain, just like World War II for everybody wondering, and how they tricked the populace through the media and instigated a war with Germany because they felt threatened. So it's a great book. I'm loving it. You're going to love the show. So hopefully we'll get enough time to do part one of that. And I still have a big debate coming up November 11th. They confirmed with Kenemy and Gary Wayne. So hopefully they send me the confirmation emails on the time. And I think that's it, guys. So I'm Jack Allen. Follow me on Twitter, Gab. I'm on Odyssey and YouTube. And as always, thanks for listening. Go follow Odd Man. And I think that's it, guys. All right. Keep reading. Keep learning. Let's keep fighting the fight. And the only way we can beat back these people is by arming ourselves with knowledge. I'm out. Peace. All right. I think I'm live. Let me just record. All right. So everyone, welcome to another episode of Conspiracy or Just a Coincidence. So today I have my book club only member so far. We're accepting applications at all times. The Odd Man. Odd Man, thanks for being on the show, dude.
Oh man, I've been looking forward to this ever since you asked me. It's always a pleasure to be on with you.
Yeah, dude. And like I said, we're always accepting applications to join our book club. So please, we need more readers because we only have so much time. But the first thing I wanted to, you first talked about Cecil Rhodes when we first met like 2 years or whatever, whenever it was. And I heard about the round table. That's what it's called. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like, I heard what you said, and I guess it's like that stupid American thinking coming from America. You're like, okay, so this British guy is powerful, but our players are the real players. This guy is just on the outskirts. So I guess tell everybody like what Cecil Rhodes and the Fabians and all these kind of, and as you know, the Cliff Notes version. I know it's a huge topic.
Yeah, man. So, well, Cecil Rhodes is probably one of the most important figures in modern history, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
I mean, the things that came from his plans that are going on right now, especially under the Great Reset, I think it's just amazing. So he was a guy who was born in the UK in England and from a fairly wealthy family, but it was like he had this vision while he was in college. He had all these upper middle class and wealthy friends. And he knew what he wanted to do, and that was basically to devise a plan to take over the world. And I'm not joking when I say that. And somehow he also knew early on that he was going to die fairly young. So he set up this series of, I think, seven wills. So in between that time, after he graduated, and I should say he was also very influenced by a professor at Oxford. Last name was Ruskin, I think John Ruskin. And he was one of these guys who was like an English firster, England firster. He really was, he pushed that whole thing of England, you know, because it was once the most powerful country in the world, you know, controlled so much of the world. And he wanted that to happen again. And in fact, he wanted it to take over America. And so that really stuck with Cecil Rhodes. And so he was basically, once he graduated, funded by the Rothschilds and I think partly by the royal family to go over to South Africa and mine for the gold and diamonds. And that's what he did. And I think it's what's called Zimbabwe now. It was called something else then, I forget, but yeah. He changed it eventually to Rhodesia, named after him.
So narcissistic. Right. Crazy. Crazy.
And so, you know, he devised this plan to form these secret societies to infiltrate government and basically, especially the United States government and the UK government. And he had all these well-to-do friends who helped him. And when you're connected like that with all these very rich, wealthy people, and some of them are already in government and heads of industry and stuff like that, you can understand it wouldn't be that hard to do. So he had these meticulous plans to do that. He wanted it to be like the, he mentioned in his wills that he wanted it to be like the Jesuits, basically. What they're known for is their organization and infiltration, and he wanted it to be something like that. He was a Freemason, but he kind of thought that the Masons took the whole wearing the garb and the uniforms and stuff like that too serious. And he wanted to focus more on just getting things done instead of symbology. So, you know, he had all these guys, several of them were, there were a couple that were Rothschilds. I think Nathan Rothschild was in the first group. I think he called the first group, I can't remember if it was the Round Table. There's all these different names. And I think that's what kind of throws people off. And then certain writers call them different names, but the early group that he formed together was like the Round Table, the Rhodes Round Table. He had a circle of initiates. He had all these guys that are well-to-do, and one of the main things I think that's important for people to remember is he started, and this is one of the big groups he started, was the Rhodes Scholarships. And so these were meant to not only educate people, but to educate them in a way that they would have a favorable kind of view of England and kind of go along with kind of helping his group to push England into being at the top of all countries. Mm-hmm. And so when you start digging through history and seeing who all in important levels in government, but especially in the upper levels of education and even in newspapers like George Stephanopoulos is a Rhodes Scholar.
I didn't know he was.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Rachel Maddow. Rachel Maddow is a Rhodes Scholar.
I didn't know she was. I know Bill Clinton, the big name.
Yeah.
But I wanted to ask one more. But so also yeah. Rhodes, I saw that in like this book that I'm reading, The Secret Origins of World War One. Like they've been playing these both sides of the. So the story was there was this guy, I forget his name. I think Kitchener. No, it wasn't. But anyway, whoever it was, he was this guy that was great friends with Cecil Rhodes, believed in everything he believed in. They were good friends, confidants. Well, during the Boer War, when they're down there in South Africa trying to start a war so they can get all the minerals they found that are under these peaceful farmers' land. Well, his guy at the last minute, he has a change of heart and he says, oh, I'm pro Boer, pro South African, like, you know, get Brits out of there. So he becomes an advisor to the president of South Africa at the time. And what do you know? He's working on their side, but he didn't just have a change of heart. He's playing the other side to make sure the events happen that Rhodes envisioned was, you know, mm-hmm. Brits taking over South Africa. But I just found that insane. You know, like it's the same thing.
Yeah. And I'm sorry, I kind of skipped some things there. But you know, and for people that don't know, and I didn't know too. So it was the Dutch that lived in South Africa in that area, right? And it was called the Free Orange State or something like that.
Yeah, something like that.
And I think they had migrated there to get away from British rule, if I remember correctly, a few decades before that.
Yeah, I think they just wanted like peace. They just wanted to farm in peace.
Right.
I mean, they were religious, yeah.
So, you know, they were on land that had the diamonds and the gold, and that wasn't going to go over well with the whole round table. And like I said, a lot of lords were mixed up in there from the royal family. And a lot of these guys are in the round table that weren't lords at the time, were appointed as lords and knights and different things like that after this whole Boer War and how they really schemed to get that done. And one thing I learned, and thank you for turning me on to that book, is the way they really pushed the wars. They call them the Boer Wars, because I think they call the Dutch the Boers. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
They really pushed them and pushed them until they had no other option but to kind of attack England. And when they did, not England, like on their land, but over in South Africa.
Yes. Yeah.
And when they finally did, you know, it was a small kind of deal. And then, of course, England had amassed this huge army with all their wealth that they had stolen from the Boers.
Right.
And so they just pretty much decimated them.
It's like that classic tat. Like we have seen it so many. It's just such a shame people don't care about history, because it's the same move as there's something they want on your land. So you're not going to give it to them. So they have their troops. They make this claim. Oh, they killed our soldiers in cold blood. And then they blast it all over the news media, you know, now then the papers, but now TV, like, fighters attacked American soldiers. They were just there to help and keep the peace. And then the whole world come, you know, all of Britain gets up in arms. If they get their people all around. So they're like, yeah, let's get them back. And now you get your huge army and they're there for until they get what they want. It's just the same thing. Right. I mean, how many times have they done that? Like Guatemala, everywhere, dude, everywhere. They've done this.
Yeah.
They've done the same thing.
Yeah. If people are not familiar, I'd say look up the book, War is a Racket by Smedley Butler. And he was like a major general, highest general in his time. And he was pre-World War II. And he had a change of heart. And he explained in that short book how he'd been basically a high price hitman. He called it for capitalism, and that'll make people mad, but it, you know, and I always try to make the difference, or, you know, it wasn't pure capitalism, because capitalism is, you know, it's a free exchange of goods and services. Mm-hmm. They weren't about that. They were about protectionism and just like taking right. over, you know, it was more like, I guess, corporatism or sort of like corporatism.
Right.
But, so we've, you know, our military and the British military have been all over the world, just destroying people, raping the land. In that Boer War, I think, didn't they say that there was like nearly 30,000 women and children?
Yeah,
they died
in concentration camps and starved them. They beat, they raped them, all these things. And the UK, and the just like today, the press covers it up. Like they control the Rothschild control. They funded, you know, Rhodes, as you know. They bought the Suez Canal for the royal family to have the largest shares in the Suez Canal. It's funny how it came back in the news, but the Rothschilds, they were brilliant. I mean, evil, but brilliant. And then they control the papers. So, and I thought like it was a CIA creation controlling the news. It goes back since the news began, I imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like they told you what side they wanted pushed, and that's what happened. And that's how you felt.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's one thing I noticed too. At every step, they had somebody important from the media, from the newspapers, which were huge at the time.
Right.
Of course, W.T. Stead was the main guy for Rhodes at first, and he wrote Rhodes' biography, and he was a huge newspaper editor and columnist. and also an occultist, by the way. Yeah, but like every other, you know, they just keep talking at every level. There's somebody from one of the big newspapers that was working with them to help them to get over whatever they wanted done and make it look like it was the right thing to do. And of course, I don't have the quote in front of me, but I know Rhodes in his will said that why shouldn't they take over the newspapers? Because the newspapers mold the minds of the people. So he knew in the 1800s that they needed to do that. And they were probably already doing that at a certain level then.
Dude, I just saw William Stead was also a survivor on the Titanic.
Really?
What are the odds of that? What are the odds of that, dude? And he met with that William Randolph Hearst, who was, you know, he was a scumbag in California or whatever. I forget what But
interesting.
I can't believe you survived. But they were just so... you know, so evil, but so brilliant that they could manipulate the populace with like the newspaper and propaganda. And I know propaganda has been around since ancient times, but you just, I think maybe I'm like thinking like a boomer here, but like how, like, oh, I remember when the news told the news, you know, like William Cronkite wouldn't lie to me, but now they lie.
Yeah.
You know, they've lied forever.
Absolutely, man. It's amazing how they've gotten away with it, you know. And, you know, you look to, you know, out of that whole Rhodes round table, and they branched off and had the first thing was the Royal Institute of International Affairs, which was like a think tank / institute to kind of like work with foreign policy in England. And then that was 1920. Well, 1921, they created the Council on Foreign Relations here. And so those groups, like I was on a show a while back. What's the name of it? It's the three British guys. I like those guys a lot.
Amish Inquisition.
Yeah. Sorry, guys. I love your show. But like, and I mentioned Chatham House, and those guys weren't even familiar with it. I was really surprised because that's their CFR over there. They changed Royal Institute of International Affairs to Chatham House for some reason, because that was the house they used to have their meetings in.
Yeah.
But it's a huge deal over there. I've even seen members of parliament talking about Chatham House, and they have Chatham House rules, which is whatever you talk about in Chatham House, you do not repeat.
Like the Vegas.
Exactly. So, you know, people talk about the CFR. Oh, well, we can see what the CFR are doing, because they talk about it online, and they have their online magazine, Foreign Affairs, and they post all these articles. No, you don't know everything, because they follow Chatham House rules, and they have these inner orders where they have these meetings and put these policies and legislation together. They're going to get to government, and we don't know everything about them, you know. And I'm sure not everybody in there, it's such a huge institution, not everybody even knows the history that we're talking about. They probably think, you know, that it's such some great institution that just wants peace and love and equality for the world. Right.
Well, this is a perfect... Oh, sorry.
No.
I was going to say, this is a perfect segue to what... Because I message Oddman all the time, my thoughts, as I'm earlier on my journey than him. But we talked... So then with Cecil Rhodes and all these guys, they wanted British supremacy. So they were colonialism and imperialism, all these things. As we all know, they would go to foreign lands, dominate, make up a fake event to send the military to rape and pillage and institute colonial rule. Well, what happened? So like the CFR there and all these organizations now are so woke and left leaning. What do you think happened to make this huge switch? Because it's clearly opposite, like it looks opposite end beliefs.
Yeah, it really does. And that's a great question. You know, I go over that in my head too, and I've been trying to figure that out. Because like one thing I left out was, I think it was 1890 is when Cecil Rhodes put forth the first plan that we need to have the secret society. And he even said in his writings, it would probably take about 100 years to get this global governance or whatever he called it. I think he didn't call it New World Order. I think he called it like one world governance or something like that. But anyway, it turns out exactly 100 years from that date, George H.W. Bush gave that famous NWO speech. So
100 years from that date.
Yeah.
And 11 years from that day was 9/11.
Exactly.
Yeah. Wow. Very interesting.
Yeah, it's like, you know, I wonder, is it just the fact that, you know, they've pushed this left wokeness to the point where it's gone so far that now these people have taken over the CFR and all kinds of businesses and colleges and everything you can imagine. And it's just, it's kind of going backwards on them, you know, or not backwards exactly, but it's not, you don't hear a lot about England. Like when I talk about this whole Rose Roundtable era type thing and his plan for domination, people are like, you know, England's not that strong. You know, they don't even take them that serious,
right. But
they don't understand all this history and what England was and how they wanted to get back to it. And, you know, I maybe some of that's been lost, you know, because patriotism definitely kind of falls away, I think, after so many generations. And, you know, that was 100 years ago. In fact, 100 years, 1921 was Council on Foreign Relations implementation, creation, or whatever. And of course, you know, we're celebrating that this year.
Yeah.
And look at all the shit that's going on.
No, that's a good point. Patriotism then to now, it, you know, everything's so much closer and quicker. And like, you know, communication wise, it doesn't really matter where your HQ it really is.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, I think a lot of these people, they do want the global governance still. But you know, Cecil Rhodes wanted the global governance, those people that were with him, but they wanted England to be at the top of it. You know, it was going to have a hierarchy. And maybe, you know, with so many years that have passed, the English being at the top has taken, you know, a back seat, or maybe it doesn't even figure in anymore, you know? So they just want the, you know, that one world government, which they thought they were going to get with the League of Nations. In fact, I've got a Dennis L. Cuddy book. I tried to find the quote right before we went on, but I couldn't find it. He actually had the dates in there where they actually already about 10 years or maybe 20 years before the United Nations was formed, they were already calling it the United Nations. Like they had this plan.
Wow.
So they had all that stuff on the back burner, you know, and I think once the League of Nations got shot down, that's when I think they started, or at least this is what I think. Because now if you mention world government or the NWO or, you know, even globalism to an extent, you'll be made fun of. And, you know, the news and mainstream acts like you're just crazy. Put on your tinfoil hat. Here comes the one world government guy. But it used to be talked about openly in the newspapers. And you can go back and see news clips and kind of like mini documentaries about them talking about world government and the League of Nations and stuff like that. And I think that there must have been a concerted effort after that to kind of like, okay, we're going to make this seem like it's crazy and just a preposterous idea, but all along we're going to be working, you know, behind the scenes to create it. And I think Arthur Schlesinger, famous historian, and he was part of the roundtable. He actually has a quote about that. He said, and I don't have it in front of me again, but it's something like, all the time we're denying it with our lips, we're working with our hands to create the one world government. So that was after League of Nations fell apart.
Yeah. No, it's just, I think that's a good point. Maybe time remove that like national identity, and they realize that that maybe creates more issues. So it was, you could, because they even did it then, like the Rothschilds, they bought their way into the royal families with loans, and they would do the same thing with countries. Like, oh, we'll give you this loan so you can industrialize and catch up to the modern world, knowing they're never going to pay them back. And then they can just install a leader that allows them to, and maybe that's just an easier way to manage your provinces, just like America does with army bases. I'm sure tactics evolve over time. You realize, it's easier to use military to strike down the forces. That's harder than to just install an elected leader and pound them with propaganda. And they're much more controllable that way.
Yeah. Yeah. It's cleaner that way, you know, and you can pretend like you have this democracy or republic or whatever. It's really all about the PSYOP, you know, and they are masters of it. Even back then, you know, the way they started the Boer War, and then ended up, you know, working over the British government completely and infiltrating it. And then starting WW1. I mean,
and it's so I talked to Ami about but Winston Churchill, everyone's, you know, boomers love Winston Churchill. World War II people love Winston Churchill. Well, Winston Churchill, for people listening, got his fame because he was in the Boer War. He was like a regular guy, and he gets caught in a POW camp for the South Africans, which I think were Germans and Dutch. I know you said Dutch. I think Germans were there as well. But regardless, he gets caught and he's starved. He's tortured. So he says, I got to escape. So he crawls through the mud and through the South African terrain, dodging bullet. And this is all written down in his story. I can like link it. He dodges bullets. He for 3 days, he crawls. He gets to a house. They give him water. He runs to a train. He jumps on a moving train. He takes that train to the coast and he hops on a boat. He has no money. So he sneaks on the boat and that boat just conveniently is going back to Britain. And that's his story. And he gets back. He never has to fight ever again. He never has to show up as like a soldier. Now he gets all this recognition. He writes about how horrible he plays right into the, I guess Cecil Rhodes is dead at this point, but you know, the pro-war, pro-British supremacy faction says, oh, they're evil. They're these horrible people, torture. And that's the Winston Churchill's beginnings. And he was a conservative in the British government and he flip-flopped to the liberal side. Or maybe it was vice versa. I don't know. But which he flipped, go ahead. Was it?
I think it was because I listened to that earlier. Yeah, flip flop to the liberal side. And I think the same thing happened with Balfour, Lord Balfour, who played a huge part too in a lot of different things.
Yeah.
These guys don't care.
No. And that is, again, like, so anybody, I was just telling Ami about like the election. Like, I was happy that the Republicans won. Because I'm still like, we're indoctrinated with that propaganda that like, that's your team. They're good guys. Well, maybe they're the lesser bad guys or whatever it is. But these people literally do not care at all. They, like Winston Churchill, a war hero, switched his political beliefs, switched parties. So did, I think, like you said, and then there was that Lloyd George, George Lloyd, not to be confused with George Floyd, but. Lloyd Boy George or whatever they call it. He was like, this great British speaker. He was the workers' man politician. They loved him. He said he was going to, you know, break down these barriers and get you a good working pay. And what happens to him? He has a little problem with prostitutes and alcohol. So what do? They ply him with alcohol, gambling, prostitutes. And what do you know? Now he signed everything he does goes against the working man, even though he's in the street saying, I'm going to get you equal pay or whatever he'll say. And then it never happens because he's addicted to alcohol and prostitutes and people still, you know, this was in the turn of the century of the 18 to 1900s. And now what's different? Like different?
Exactly. Yeah. Cause like I look back at just my time paying attention to politics and you had like, of course, Romney was a Democrat, and then like, oh, a few years later, he's a Republican. Let's run him.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he was a Democrat. I know there's been several people like that, and of course, McCain was basically he was like half and half, I guess. They call him the Maverick, but he's like, in the meantime, he's in bed with the Saudis and the Rothschilds and all these different people, Soros and all that. So it's like these guys don't care, and if people. You know, I know a lot of people have a hard time thinking, well, how could this group plan something so far ahead? Because we can't do, you know, I always say I can't even plan anything next week. But
for dinner, let alone dinner tomorrow night.
Right. But I think it might help people to understand that this is generational. And if these people in each generation knows they have to play along with these groups of people and they've already grown up with them anyway, to keep their wealth, they must play this game and be a part of these institutions. Well, they're going to do that because nobody wants to be broke, you know? And so I think greed is a huge factor in the reason that it's all, you know, that they've kept it together for the most part. And also, like in that book, they mentioned that a lot of these families, just like the families that started the Federal Reserve, a lot of these elites intermarried. So you have all these families that continue this time and time again, and they're just playing along with that same old script until, you know, they finally get exactly what they want.
Well, that's a great point. Like, it doesn't, I mean, I think it is sometimes more sinister and occult things, but greed, and not maybe greed, yes, but also just like that. Imagine if people said to you, you know what, because you're white, we're going to tax you an extra 50%. We would be up in arms. And you, and it's not only just because it's unfair, but because you're like, well, my family, my generations worked for where I'm at today for it to have this level of wealth or what, not, you know what I mean, wealth, but
Yeah.
and you're gonna fight like hell to stop it. So if you, these elite people there on top, and they feel threatened, just like a normal person would feel threatened, they're gonna easily go along because they've, like, just like how you, we, all of us, it's like human nature, the people beneath us, you care about them, but to what, not more than you care about your own family line and your own self. So that's how these people view us, is, well, I need to keep my wealth. There's where we are replaceable, the people at the bottom. So they're gonna easily, they're, it's gonna take so, you, who's gonna willingly risk your family's wealth, safety, wealth to help people beneath you? Like, that's
Right.
especially
Exactly.
not these people.
Yeah, and that's a good time, I think, to mention because it reminded me of something. I've been looking into Fabian socialists, and I never knew much about them. I mean, I know a little bit about socialism, of course, but like I didn't realize that the difference, kind of the approach that the Fabians had. And so George Bernard Shaw is probably the most famous besides H.G. Wells, but they started that whole thing out being like anti-war and peace and equality. And by the end, George Bernard Shaw was saying we need to just kill off the poor, and he was still a Fabian. So I think. And those circles kept intermingling. The Fabians, I keep reading these books and these quotes where Fabian socialists were hanging out with the Rhodes Roundtable people and the CFR people. And you would think that they would be opposite in a way because you've got obviously the Rhodes Roundtable people would be considered capitalist and high up on that chain of capitalism, which we talked about. It's not true capitalism, it's like
Right.
protectionism. But the Fabians, they like money. And that's what I didn't realize about the Fabians. And so their approach was a slow approach. See here on the screen, you see down at the bottom right there, there's like a black a wolf. And if
Yeah.
you look closely, it's a wolf in sheep's clothing. And the wolf is taking
Yeah.
the. So they were really bold. You have the Fabian window here, it's like the stained glass. And that one of those is George Bernard Shaw, and the other guy,
No way.
I think his name's Sidney Webb, if I'm not mistaken. And there is a quotation, I think, on there. It says something like "Remold it to the heart's desire," and it's from a book. And they're basically pounding the world to make it as they want it to be. And if you
Damn.
look down at the bottom in the center, there's a stack of books, and these are the books that they, I guess, think that are the most important. And I know one is by H.G. Wells. I can't remember the other books. Maybe one is George Bernard Shaw. But that's an interesting kind of.
Wasn't I think Dyer references George Bernard Shaw a lot, doesn't he? He talks about how, like, I think Bernard, oh no, it was Bertrand Russell. Never
Oh,
mind.
yeah.
Never mind.
I think Bertrand was a Fabian. If he wasn't, he definitely hung out with the Fabians a little bit later on.
Because his quote was like, in 100 years, you'll be eating the top will be eating, meat while you'll be eating gruel or bugs or I forget whatever he said.
Right.
But
Yeah. Like lab grown meats and
right.
stuff like
Yeah.
that.
But
Yeah.
it's, oh, go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was just gonna say, yeah, it's like him and the Huxleys, and of course Brave New World, Aldous Huxley has all these like just fantastic, timeless quotes about what the future's gonna look like. And I think Brave New World was a prediction of that, but he was one of them. So I don't know if he straddled the line and it was kind of like I don't want the future to be like this, but I'm in the club and I don't want to mess
Yeah.
that up. Or
Right.
maybe, maybe he wasn't really against it and it just kind of seems like that. But his quotes, just about all of them, have come true and even more accurate, I think, than George Orwell. And he was George Orwell's professor. So,
Wow, dude.
yeah.
Well,
If you scroll up just a little bit, there's a
yeah.
turtle there.
Yeah.
You see the tortoise?
Yeah, I got
And
him up.
so the tortoise became their other logo for a time. I don't see it right there. Oh, yeah, it says I strike.
It says, I strike hard. I can't see what this says. Way? I don't know what that says.
Something about, I forget now, but it was like, it's basically like saying I may go slowly, but I strike hard.
Oh.
And so that describes the Fabians, because their whole idea is to move slowly and infiltrate governments and businesses. Dude. They didn't want to get rid of capitalism or big business, even though they were against all this Victorian era, you know, like the pomp and all that, because that was their fathers and grandfathers and they were rebelling against them. But they didn't actually.
Dude.
Yeah, but they didn't actually want to be poor. So their idea was, we will, instead of, like, they started out as Marxists. But like, once they got the Fabian Society together, and they immediately started writing pamphlets and all this literature, because they were a bunch of smart people. There's no question about that. But their whole idea was, we're going to infiltrate these businesses and take them over. We're not going to be like Marx wanted this violent revolution. Basically, that's, he, you know, kind of thought that's the only way that things would change. And we're like, no, we're going to do it peacefully by infiltration. And so,
damn,
they were hanging out with all these Rhodes people, and that was probably one reason. Much,
you're always ahead of the curve, odd man. Again, when you're telling me the Fabians, I was like, social, whatever. But that, all those things you just said make perfect sense. Like, look at where we're at today. Like, that would be a great reason why they would stop going to these countries to dominate with military. Say this Fabian society, they want this utopia. They still want to have power, but they, you know, want it to be not with monarchies. And this is a great, you infiltrate businesses, you infiltrate politics, and you slowly, you'll keep your wealth, those people at the top, but everybody else in the middle class is going to be gone, and you're going to spread that wealth all over.
Exactly. Yeah. Cause they wanted to be in charge. They want to be a part of the hierarchy. You know, we'll make everything equal for the peasants. You guys, we'll make everything equal, but we're going to have this hierarchy. And it's pretty interesting, because they came from well-to-do families. Almost all of the Fabians, I think there was one guy who was a painter, and they actually let him write like one pamphlet, because their pamphlets, you can actually go on archive.org and read most of them. It's amazing what they've been able to do. I was reading a book, I can't remember. I've got like three or four Fabian books I'm trying to read at the same time.
Damn. Just
pulling out quotes and stuff. I think it's Fabian Freeway, but don't quote me on that. But they're talking about in there how many different representatives from the UK government, the British government, that have been Fabians. It's pretty amazing. And this was an old book, so they had already infiltrated it by, I think, like the 50s.
So this, I talked to you about this theory before, but on my show, but at this current stage of reading, I believe that all these economic, you know, communism, socialism, capitalism, it all doesn't matter to these groups at all. The only thing they want to maintain is the status quo for themselves, the elite, and they'll create these countries with these different systems to play off on one another, to say, oh, look at this country, they're evil, they're communist, that's what we're going to do to you if you don't fight for this. And I think that kind of like relates with this, because socialism, it's not that everyone does, it's just that the top are untouchable. You cannot get in. No, there is no move upward mobility, and people are in their place forever. And that's how you would control a populace perfectly, because there's no upward mobility. They barely have enough to get by, but everyone barely has enough to get by.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I really think, because like Carnegie started out, you know, he was called like a vicious capitalist, one of the most, one of the richest men in the world at his day. And by the time he was older, he was like a Fabian, or leaned towards the way they believe. And so he wanted a one world socialist government, and actually talked about it. And he was a part of the whole, like, he wasn't, I'm not sure if he was one of the Rhodes Roundtable people, but he was definitely friendly to Rhodes. And I think I sent you a quote where he was basically saying that Rhodes' plan is a good plan or whatever. I actually wrote that up in a newspaper.
Wow.
And so, you know, these guys, I think they get so much money, and maybe they have a little bit of guilt. And so, like, we'll call ourselves a socialist, and we'll want this one world socialism, and it looks good because all the, you know, woke people want that too, or think they want that.
Right.
But at the top, like we're just saying, they're gonna be at this place that other people will never be able to touch. And and the Fabians, again, in the Rhodes Roundtable, you see the Carnegie Endowment come up all the time with those two groups and the different Carnegie organizations. So they were all over, and especially the education. Of course, I know you did that great episode about Skull and Bones and how they had basically started higher ed and stuff like that. But here, like John Dewey, they call him, I guess, the father of education. He was a Fabian.
Was he, dude?
He signed the Human Manifesto, Humanist Manifesto. And I think it was Horace Mann. I get Horace Mann and Horace Greeley mixed up. One was a newspaper guy, and the other guy was another educator. But these guys were Fabian socialists, and they wanted that Prussian model.
Right.
In fact, one of the guys was the one, one of the Horaces, I believe, was the one that went over to Prussia and saw it and wanted to bring that back here. So,
yeah.
Dude, and I was just going to say, it doesn't even take that much looking into to figure out that our education system was absolutely started by socialists who wanted a one world government. The most important guys who were part of it, they were all about that.
Right. Yeah, you're right. Like, that's exactly what you said. The Skull and Bones guys get educated in Prussia. They bring that back. They want to replicate that adoration for the state and for, like, authority. And they bring in, so kind of like to change top a little bit.
Yeah.
So, you know, I did that show on Alan Dulles and how the CIA, you know, was. And before, not just the CIA, you had like McCarthy and all these people staunch, you know, anti-communist, you know, better dead than red, and all these things like that. So I guess the trouble I have with this connection is all these things are started by Fabian socialists and other people that want the elite to be untouchable and all of us in the bottom peasant class. So how do you work together the two that the deep state, in America, the intelligence apparatus was staunchly like Republican? Time magazine and all that, Henry Lou, all these people were all staunch Republicans running cover and attacking and labeling people socialists and communists.
Yeah, that is very interesting to me too. You know, I can't really say 100% for sure, but I think that, those same guys, or at least the Dulleses, were definitely pro-Hitler. I mean, because they were all about doing business with the, you know, the Nazis during World War II.
They were.
So I don't know exactly. I believe that they perhaps wanted a war with Russia to get in and get their minerals. And I could be wrong, but I mean, they always want the minerals, it seems like.
Right, yeah.
But also, having that enemy all those years, look how it allowed them to screw the American people over, scare us to death, and make us pliable. And in the meantime, you know, a lot of these, like Anthony Sutton, you know, wrote in his books, The Best Enemies Money Can Buy, and that, I forget the other book, but like the communists were actually being paid in foreign aid.
Right.
And they were turning around and buying weapons,
right,
and they were buying stuff to make weapons from American companies.
Yes.
And then, you know, like Rockefeller, and I think, of course, it seems like we really started to do business with China under Nixon. Mm-hmm. And then there was Rockefeller, who was a big Chinese guy, you know, proponent of doing business with China. And so he brought that whole thing about. And but I think they just realized, hey, we can make a lot of money with China. We don't have to pretend to be at war with them any longer or be at war with them.
Well, ideological enemies are the best enemies, right? Because they, but I find it like interesting as well that, like you said, Wall Street funded all these people's rise to power, whether it was Hitler or communist Russia. Harriman gave them loans for railroads and all this stuff, but and then would come back and say, oh, they're building up their infrastructure. We got to build, even though he's over there helping them build it. But I think, and like with Hitler, I've been like thinking a lot about this because, as we know, Wall Street funded Hitler's rise to power. He wouldn't have been able to do what he did without all of his financial support. And so I think, and you said they loved business. They loved the making money was so important to them and, you know, everywhere. So they funded this guy in Germany to rebuild because Germany was an industrial powerhouse. Then they realized when they get Hitler in power, maybe he has too much power. So now they have to, and he's creating too much nationalism because they're kicking all of these foreign investments kind of out of Germany now that they have what they need. So I wonder, like, that's their real fear isn't socialism or communism, but it's nationalism. And that is why they pound us with globo homo, globalist everything, because they're terrified that if the populace wakes up and says, get the hell out, then that's when they lose.
Absolutely. I think personally, after, you know, really trying to study these things and really trying to figure out exactly what was the whole goal and who's really in charge and all that stuff, I think you're right, man. I think nationalism is the one thing they hate the most, because if you look at it, the round table, the CFR, the Chatham House, Royal Institute of International Affairs, all these different groups, for the most part, even NATO, are about internationalism or working with several other different countries. They don't want any one nation to be self-sufficient, because if they do, then they won't be doing business with these international conglomerates. And so I think that's one of the biggest things. And if they definitely want central banks in these countries to create the debt, you know, and all these people in these huge corporations in banking and lending and all that are part of this CFR group and this internationalist, you know, call it what you want, cadre, cabal, right, whatever. And it allows them to work with one another and just destroy competition. And they can decide if a country doesn't want to play along, well, we're going to put sanctions on you. And if you don't, if you still refuse, and we'll starve you people, your people, and we won't let you get medicines and all these different things. And if you still don't play along, then we'll say that you are a threat to us, or you're threatening the small Hadistan country in the Middle East. And I really do, you know, just bringing that up, you know, the Lord Balfour and the Rothschilds were behind the modern state of Israel, getting it there. And you know, right, I know this is like a touchy situation, but I believe, and this wasn't my thought, but it was Eustace Smallins, who people say was anti-Semitic, but a lot of things he said was right. And I don't know if he was anti-Semitic or not, but he said that, you know, that basically the whole thing was they needed to have that modern state of Israel over there. They needed to have a country over there that wasn't Muslim so they could operate out of there militarily. And it makes a lot of sense. Like Joe Biden's, like a couple years ago, he said, I think it was before the Senate, you know, if there wasn't a modern state of Israel, America would have to invent one to protect its assets.
Wow, dude.
He said that, dude. That.
Oh, my God.
So it all goes back to these internationalists doing business around the world, and that's who's behind globalism. But they tried to twist it, I think. And I do believe that there were communists behind that, too, that were going along with it. But they tried to make it look like it was just communists, just Russia, these evil communists who just want to enslave you. And I do, after kind of looking into McCarthy deeper, I do believe that there was that threat for sure. But I don't think it was as grave as we were made to think it was. And so I believe that those moneyed powers, along with our government, of course, and the press, use that to their full advantage. Like you're saying, they need a threat so they can get away with all kinds of stuff.
Dude, I think that's a great point where you brought up at the beginning, that you make countries dependent. You remove industry. You remove, so you cannot be a self-sustaining country to encourage globalism. Because we all ask, like, how did the United States go from this manufacturing powerhouse? And everyone will say, you know, money obviously plays a huge role. But if we know how these elite people operate, Their idea is we need to remove the self-sustaining ability from the United States because these people love freedom and liberty and started supposedly on liberty, and you got to get it out of there. So now we are completely, if something ever happened for America, we would be totally screwed. We would be, no medicines made here. Food is all like grown in Mexico. I mean, obviously there's some people in the middle of America, but I mean, we would be screwed. We would literally be screwed. And I think that's such a key part of what pushed that was that they cannot have to remove nationalism. You make sure that they can't be a self-sustaining country.
Absolutely. And if you think about it, you know, nobody knows how to do anything anymore to help themselves, to work on like vehicles, build houses, farm. Farm is like one of the most important things you could learn, you know, and I want to know more about it myself. I should. I'm from the South. I should know how to farm, but I don't. But like, you know, fish, hunt, those kinds of things. Everything in society, all the popular like pop culture has pushed us to not do those things and to worship this tech and spend all our time on watching TV and movies and playing video games and playing with our phones and stuff like that. And they've made us more and more dependent with the welfare state and with the warfare state too, because they're always coming up with things, you know, we got to save you from terrorism. We got to save you from, you know, this, that, or the other. And of course it was communism in the, you know, in the past, the Cold War. And now it's, of course, the cough, you know, and but it's like
the Chi-Coms.
The Chi-Coms. Yeah. So we're a nation of very dependent people, and that makes us so much weaker. And so that's us as individuals. They've made where we can't do things on our own. But then, like you said, we can't get all these different, you know, products and different things that we need now because they're not made here any longer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, dude. I think that's, I never thought of that point, but it's just, it goes into even like how I've been saying on my show, and I'm not far enough yet in my Hans Hoppe book about the monarchy being the best form of government, but World War One, I mean, all these wars were wars to end or to kill any nationalistic tendency. Like they needed to knock, Germany was flying ahead of the UK in power right in the 18 to 1900s, the early. And the only way to stop this, the UK was, and they have a Kaiser that has a lot of power, not more power than the UK queen at that time did. And same with so that they were terrified because if that grew, that would remove these horrible corporate capitalists from being able to rape and pillage your country. And that's what World War One was about. They needed to knock out the monarchies. And then World War II is the same kind of thing. You had these Hitler and Mussolini, people that were, they weren't bloodline, they weren't a monarchy, but they were an all-powerful king, and really, essentially, right? When you agree, you know. And so they can't, again, you cannot have that if you want to rape and pillage your these countries. You can't do it if you have a leader that will stand up for their people. Even if that includes violence and horrible things, you still can't have that.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's one thing I failed to mention too. I know at one point in that book about the Boer War and everything, I know they mentioned that in South Africa, the Round Table, the Rhodes guys, they had established private police and even private roads.
Yeah.
And they were absolutely just, they were terrorizing the people and just treating people like horrible, you know. They couldn't travel places because the roads were private. And look, dude, you know how I've told you I was pretty libertarian and I still have some of those leanings, but like now I'm a realist, you know. I'm like, okay, how would this look and how would it end up if it was really implemented? And that's a good example is the Rhodes Roundtable. These elites are going to be the rulers, because the people that have the most money are going to rule. You know, you might find one good billionaire that's going to try and make things fair amongst like, you know, 30 or 40 maybe, but he's not going to be able to overpower those other guys.
Right.
So you see that they had their private police beating the shit out of people. Yeah. They wouldn't let them travel. They were jailing people for walking across the street, you know, stuff like that. So I think people better think about maybe some of these libertarian ideas and how, if they ended up in the wrong hands, which they will, what they would really
Dude, it's so funny that you brought, because I was doing my notes for my show. I'm trying to finish them before tomorrow. And I thought of you when they, because like just like you said, they went down there, they built a private army. The UK cabinet gave them ultimate power to defend their investments. So what do people think that like a free market, that's a free market. That's a free market without a strong state to protect the residents of the said state. And the free market will literally treat like they are emboldened because this is their company or their country. And imagine if they're an Amazon police force, an Amazon military, like they would do you even worse than the state could do to you because there's zero recourse. What are you going to do? What are you going to do?
Right. Cause they would have the state paid off anyway. Cause we know, you know, unfortunately we know that these lobbyists and these big, huge companies write most of the bills, you know, and our guys don't even read half of them, probably less than that. And so, I don't know, man, there's not, I wish there was a good, you know, like I could say, okay, if we just did this, this would fix this problem here. And this would make us more free and all this stuff. But, you know, there's a lot of details in there and things that could go wrong. I mean, you know, just those people, the people with the biggest guns, you know, and the most bullets are going to win. They're going to roll it over you.
Yeah, dude. It's just so, because I talked to that anarcho-capitalist who's a super guy, nice guy. But it's like this thinking that free market will solve all issues. That's impossible. Dude, people are just inherently, not inherently, but people they want what's best for them, their family, and since the dawn of time, the weaker have been dominated by the stronger. So if you have an all-powerful company that can rape and pillage land, that can have a private art, private roads, all these things, like the state, that's why you need to have some form of a powerful state to have a somewhat good society, because without a state, you will be ran over. You will be ran the F over.
Yeah, man. I lean towards like a minarchist kind of situation, you know, like minimal government with a really involved populace.
Yeah.
Because like you said, man, it's always going to end up the same way, unfortunately. I mean, maybe on a small scale, if you were allowed to have like a little town or a village and we're just going to trade with each other. I think the black market is a free market, you know, if it's not messed with, you know, a guy that runs a fruit stand, that's free market. You know, he can go over there and I can go over to him and I can buy, you know, a watermelon or a squash or whatever, you know, I give him some money or even the barter system. But yeah, I mean, these elites, we haven't had, you know, a pure free market, I don't think, because maybe ever, because these guys have controlled the government. So if they control the government, it's like we need separation of not church and state, we need separation of corporation and state and banker and state. Because like, look, if you look at all the past presidencies, everyone that I've looked into, especially in the modern age, they've just been filled with Wall Street guys, no matter if it's Democrat or Republican. And so yeah, and like we talked about how they're always filled with the same CFR guys and Bilderberg attendees. And
well, I looked it up. I thought I was reading this for everyone. The book is what the secret origins of World War One. That's what we're referencing. If anyone, it's a great book if anyone wants to read it. But I thought, so when did this start? Like, when did the king, the monarchy become infiltrated with? And it was like the one that was the Rothschild in like the 1500s with, I don't know, it was the Dutch, right? The Orange family, I think.
I think so.
It was the same thing. They were running out of money. They wanted to like prepare for a war, or he was a degenerate, and they just kept loaning them money. And they got more and more power. And this alone, and they spread their Rothschild spread their seed throughout Europe and did the exact same thing in every place. And every place, it was the same result. Like, so it's just, I don't know, like if there is a perfect system, because I say monarchy, but it's just like you said, it gets the bankers or these like their greed just can work these people in and knock out any semblance of like honest and moral government in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. And it almost seems like, you know, I don't know if it would be an answer or not, but like smaller communities and just being as independent as you could be seems like would be the only way to get away from some of this. Of course, like you said, there's like certain products and stuff that we could never get now. So, you know, we're kind of forced at this point to kind of deal with the system we have for the most part.
Yeah,
that's a shame. But, you know, we can like, you know, do our own things and meet people and especially local people that can help us out.
Well, I think of the Amish, you know, the Amish community still, they like, we buy, because in Pennsylvania, we have a lot of Amish. So we buy, like, they made my parents a shed and they make all these nice, beautiful wood, put up fences in like a day. But that community has remained so great because they have a moral code that they must adhere to, or you'll be, you know, kicked out of the community. And they don't, they just go without having these things that we want to have. And I think that's the only way that you can, to be truly free. Like those people, there are no, they have literally like no rules, you know, like they don't have any, like, they obviously they can't murder somebody, but I'm sure they've done that in their community and have gotten away with it. But, you know, because that, it's just greed and these bankers and corporate capitalists, they're just so disgusting that they want to, like, I think it's becomes money becomes non a big issue. And now what's more important is that power that they get. And that's what they're searching for, because they have so much money, more than they could ever spend. But
yeah. And they, you know, they get all that money. And I think that then they probably start thinking about, well, what am I going to do with this? Where's it going to go after I die? Right. And so then they're like, I got to figure out a way to make sure this stays in my family or with the people or the groups that I like. And so that creates a whole nother, you know, kind of thing.
Well, dude, I always love talk. Where can everybody find the OG of reading in the conspiracy world?
Oh, thanks, man. It's been great. Underscore the Odd Man Out on Twitter and Instagram, and just Odd Man Out on Gab. And you can see in the links there, it's got the profile link. It's like a link tree, and you can see all my links in there. You can find the show, which is The Oddcast, FT, period, The Odd Man Out. And I appreciate it, man.
Yeah, dude, I'll link everyone. He's got a Patreon. Join me in the Odd Man is the best Patreon creator. I never post on my Patreon, but you are always good, man. And I respect Odd Man's opinion so much in so many of these areas. He's someone that, so listen to his show. You can definitely learn something. So Odd Man, thanks for being on the show, dude. We'll talk soon.
Awesome, man. Thank you.
All right, dude. Take care. Bye.
Bye.
So I hope you guys enjoyed the show. I'm trying something new. One of my Patreon supporters, he told me to, the show ends abruptly, and he is absolutely right. It ends abruptly. So I'm trying a little ending thing here. And I just finished that talk with Odd Man. Hopefully you just finished it as well. Real quick, please send a prayer out for my buddy at Mitch Vuck. Mitch was at January 6th, and obviously it was a crazy time. Propaganda works, everybody. It works. Surprise, surprise. It works. And he's facing his sentencing is coming up. He's looking at 45 days in jail, which isn't a lot, but as someone who has been incarcerated, he is such a beautiful soul. He does not deserve this. So say a prayer for him. I think his sentencing comes in December. So prayer is a great weapon we have in our arsenal to just help each other. So send a prayer out for Mitch Vuck. You can follow him on Twitter at Mitch Vuck. If you want to send him a message, I think you can, send him a message, tell him you're thinking about and you're praying for him. It would mean a lot to me, and I know it would mean a lot to him. And that's really all I wanted to close out with. Hopefully I'll have my notes done in time for tomorrow. I'm going to do my darn hardest. I got work though, so we'll see. But thanks for listening, guys. I hope you learned something in this show. I hope it helps set the tone that these politicians, if you didn't know, they've been flip-flopping, lying scumbags since politics started. So, yes, don't give them any of your hope. Don't give them any of your money. And don't give them any of your positive or negative energy. I'm Jack Allen, everyone. Thanks for listening. And hey, We are gonna get through this. I'm out. Peace.